Welcome to episode 249 of the Solomonster Sounds Off on SEScoops.com for Sunday, December 9th, 2012. I am the Solomonster. Have a couple of quick announcements here at the top of the show this week to get to. First, a very happy Hanukkah to all of our Jewish listeners out there and Paul Heyman. Hanukkah began last night. That being Saturday night, it carries on for 8 days all the way until Sunday night. And I never actually did get a different gift for each of the 8 nights when I was a little kid. But if you can swing it, it's the best holiday ever. You get a new gift every day. I mean, really, what can beat that? Christmas is only 1 day a year. Hanukkah's 8. It's pretty hard to beat. So anyway, happy Hanukkah to all of our Jewish listeners. Also, I want to make mention here that next week will be episode 250 of The Sound Off, and we'll have TLC predictions for the big pay-per-view, which is coming up next weekend. Now, I will be in attendance at the Barclays Center in Brooklyn, along with Brian Blade, at TLC. So the recording schedule is going to have to change a little bit, going to have to do the show a little bit earlier, either that same day, more likely the day before. I'll keep you guys posted on Twitter about that. But I will have TLC predictions on the show next week. And also, the day after the TLC pay-per-view, December 17th, you can mark that date down. Will be the next installment, the next edition, the next episode of SE Scoops Live. With yours truly and Noah Mark, we'll be co-hosting SE Scoops Live the day after the TLC pay-per-view, and we'll do it sometime before Raw goes on the air. I don't know if it's going to be half an hour or a full hour, if it's going to start at 7:30 or what. I don't even get home from work until well after 7, so we'll figure all that out, but there will be, at this point, an edition of SE Scoops Live before Raw that might even bleed into the beginning of Raw. That's coming up not this Monday, but next Monday, December 17th. So I just wanted to make mention of that. So the big story of the week before we get to any of the TV shows and some of the other stuff going on, obviously, is CM Punk, the WWE champion. His name was in the news this week. Pretty big deal in that CM Punk had to undergo emergency knee surgery earlier this week, on Tuesday to be exact, which would have been the day after Raw. The renowned Dr. James Andrews, who's operated on more WWE talents than I can ever even try to guess, and other sports athletes as well. He's also the one, if I remember correctly, who operated on Triple H's torn quad, probably both of them. So he's the best of the best, and that's where Punk went. So obviously there was something wrong, and he completed a scope of CM Punk's left knee on Tuesday. There was a apparently it was a cartilage tear in the knee that was repaired. I guess there was a piece of torn meniscus that was locking up the knee that was caught between Punk's femur and his tibia that was causing him some discomfort, some pain. As I said, the knee would lock up. You can kind of tell in some of his recent matches that if you go back and watch it, he was favoring the knee, and you didn't know if it was necessarily part of the match or not, but apparently he had been suffering from a legit knee injury. That has now been taken care of, and he is off the TLC pay-per-view. There was some question at first. Perhaps he would be able to stick it out and be on the show, and by all accounts, Punk was willing to be on the show. WWE erred on the side of caution, which is probably for the better. When you look at the big picture, they elected to take Punk off the pay-per-view, and the new main event for TLC on December 16th in Brooklyn at the Barclays Center will be a six-man tag team TLC match, first ever of its kind in WWE history. Team Hell No and Ryback will comprise one team. They will oppose The Shield, Dean Ambrose, Seth Rollins, and Roman Reigns in their first formal match on WWE television. It will be 1 week from now at the TLC pay-per-view. And that match can only end by pinfall or submission, which makes sense in that there's nothing to hang from the ceiling. There's no briefcase. There's no championship. It would be kind of foolish in that respect. And you already have a ladder match on the show with a briefcase hanging from the ceiling, and we'll get to that in a second. But it only made sense that this match would end on pinfall or submission. I see where some people are upset about that. I don't really know what you're upset about, because how else do you expect a TLC match with nothing on the line to end? Personally, I have no problem with it. They were put in a tough spot, and I give WWE credit for, telling Punk, listen, even if you feel like you can do this, we won't let you. Because you got to look at the big picture here. There is a big match waiting on the horizon for CM Punk, for WWE. That is, of course, at the Royal Rumble next month. CM Punk and The Rock, all roads lead there. You know, anything can happen between now and then. Ryback is apparently going to get his title shot. Just because Punk is hurt does not mean that Ryback is fucked. He is going to get his WWE Championship match. It looks like it will take place on an episode of Raw sometime before the Royal Rumble, obviously. I don't know if it'll be later this month or if it'll be sometime early in the new year. But, you know, and that also, quite frankly, is not the worst thing in the world. A Ryback CM Punk main event for the WWE Championship, a pay-per-view caliber main event, being able to now take that and... Given the lack of success that Raw has had of late in terms of viewers and ratings, and again, we'll talk about that in just a second, wouldn't be the worst thing in the world to have a big championship main event that they could go out there a week, 2 weeks in advance on television and promote and tell people, listen, this is a big deal, you better tune in. They could pop a big number for it. So again, it's not the worst thing in the world. You take a negative, you turn it into a positive. You know, you get lemons, you make lemonade, all the cliches you could think of. So that's the situation that we find ourselves in. Of course, whether or not this TLC match now will end the pay-per-view, I have no idea. It's a big match, but to me, I almost feel, and I hate to say this, but I almost feel like John Cena should headline the show, that they've invested enough in this story, ridiculous as it may be. Ziggler, Cena, now the Money in the Bank briefcase is on the line, which is, again, kind of a big deal. I guess if Ziggler is going over, maybe they don't want that to be the parting image. They want Ryback to just go out there and beat people up, which presents another interesting quandary now, because this is the Shield's first match in WWE. Do you send the Shield out there to their doom? Do you send them out there to lose in their first match? Because, you know, Ryback, to me, there was no way Ryback was walking out with the championship. I don't know anybody who honestly believed they were going to put the title on Ryback at TLC. So they were going to have to come up with some sort of finish, probably involving the Shield, interfering in the match, giving CM Punk enough time, providing enough of a distraction for him to climb the ladder and retain the championship. Well, now you can't do that. Now the Shield is wrestling. They're not going to interfere on their own behalf unless there's going to be a fourth member, you know, of the Shield revealed at the pay-per-view, and I think it's too early to start adding people to the Shield. Maybe, you know, a month or two down the road, maybe you take somebody else like Cassius Ohno or something from developmental and you can do that, but I think it's a little too early to be thinking about that. So either the Shield loses in their first match, or you beat Ryback anyway, which you were probably going to do, but... You know, Ryback, I mean, I guess what they can do, it's a six-man tag. You can have Daniel Bryan take the pinfall. That, to me, would be the most obvious finish. Or Kane. I mean, it doesn't have to be Bryan, although I think it would be of the two. I could see them saying, hey, Bryan, you know, you're taking the fall, not Kane. To me, that seems like the most likely scenario if they lose. Otherwise, you know, Ryback's getting a championship match one way or the other. You got to keep him strong. He already lost twice on pay-per-view. I don't care if he was pinned or not at Survivor Series, he still lost. How much more damage can you really do to Ryback without it starting to have an effect on his crowd reactions? The people are into him right now. They have something with Ryback. You got to walk that fine line. Be very careful here. It's fun. You know, it's fun to see the fans get behind somebody new. And you can argue if Ryback is the right guy. Oh, he's not a good wrestler. Who cares? Not everybody has to be able to wrestle, you know, like a Daniel Bryan or a CM Punk. So they have something in Ryback, and it's a trade-off. You know, what do? Do you beat him again, or do you beat the Shield in their first match? Is that going to be detrimental to the Shield if they lose in their first match? I mean, I think it could be. I think it could be. So going with the finish where somebody other than Ryback takes the fall might make the most sense. We'll find out in a week. They have some time to figure out what they want to do here. CM Punk, in the meantime, is going to continue to be on television. I expect him to be on Raw this Monday night. I don't think he's going to miss any time at all as far as being on TV. And from what I'm reading, they may play it up as being more than it is. He may come out on crutches, or he may come out in a wheelchair. The injury is not quite that serious. He should be back in action within about 3 or 4 weeks, if that. But if you see him on TV making it out to be more than it is, don't buy into it. So let's talk about Raw from Monday night, before CM Punk's surgery. Raw emanating from Greensboro, North Carolina, Flair country. Ric Flair was not on the show. Ric Flair's got his own problems these days. Ric Flair has other issues, I think, that he has to tend to before he worries about pro wrestling. Raw ratings continue their rapid descent, unfortunately, for WWE. They did their lowest numbers of the year with this week's show. And I believe their lowest, what would probably be non-holiday audience, since 1997. They lost almost, think about this, almost 500,000 viewers from last week's show. And last week's show didn't do well either. And they lost almost 500,000 people from that number last week. So that worked out to be a 2.5 rating. And this 2.5 rating comes about 6 months after the move to 3 hours. And again, I wonder who could have predicted that that would happen. I wonder. I don't know how much money they're getting from USA Network for that third hour, but whatever it is, it's not worth the damage that's being done to their A show. Raw is their number one show. I mean, Raw, they could add as many shows as they want, Main Event, Saturday Morning Slam, you know, Sunday morning shit. I mean, whatever TV shows they want to keep adding, a show for every day of the week, that's all well and good, but Raw is still their A game. That's still their flagship brand, and they're doing, hopefully, not irreparable damage. I think the longer this experiment goes on, and the longer this goes on, people just say, listen, it's a very long show. Many weeks it's boring. You can't keep my interest for 3 hours. I'll just DVR it. I'll fast forward through the parts that I don't want to see, or they'll just give up altogether. I mean, I have a lot of people who write into me and send feedback into the Sound Off that they don't even watch Raw anymore at all. And in some cases, it's because of the move to 3 hours, so they listen to the Sound Off just to keep up with what's going on. And that's not good. I mean, it makes me feel good. I appreciate that. But that's not good, you know, when people just stop watching altogether. So Raw has its 20th anniversary coming up in about a month, a little over a month. And I'm sure that they will end up doing something special on the show. Maybe they'll bring back some old faces, just like they did for Raw 1000. I'd be stunned, quite frankly, if they didn't try to replicate Raw 1000. I mean, that show did 6 million viewers in July. That's what Raw 1000 did only 5 months ago. 6 million viewers. And now they're hovering about half that. So Raw 1000 was a huge success. And I would imagine they would want to put together a show that's very similar to that. And whatever they plan, whether they bring back the same old faces or whatever it may be, I say make a big announcement that night. And that big announcement is that Raw is returning to 2 hours. And they can you know, sex it up in any way they want to. I know it might almost sound like a defeat if they just come out and admit the fact that, hey, you know, we did 3 hours, it didn't work out, so we're going back to two. They don't even have to do that. They can have this big, elaborate announcement that makes it sound like it's such a big deal, you know, starting next week or whatever, Raw, you know, the old Raw is back or whatever, and it's back to 2 hours, and as part of the move back to 2 hours, they can promote a big main event. Maybe Ryback and CM Punk, as a matter of fact, for the WWE Championship, if they save it for a week or two before the Rumble or something, and maybe they don't want to wait that long, but I think that's the way to go. Because at this point, you know, again, how much longer can you go on where your audience just continues to erode and erode? And I don't know the WWE has ever actually come out. They've had at least one of these investor conference calls since the move to 3 hours. I don't think they ever came right out and admitted how much money USA Network is giving them for that third hour. I've heard reports on other, you know, websites that it's in the range of $150,000 to $175,000, which just sounds awfully low to me. Not that $150,000 is not a lot of money, but in the context of what they get for Raw each week anyway, which I think is close to $1 million, If they're getting 150 grand for that third hour, in the grand scheme of things, I don't think it's worth it. Now, if they're getting $1 million for that extra third hour, which I guarantee you they're not, but if that were the case, then you can say, okay, you know what, it's $1 million in our pocket every week. We're going to gut this out. Believe me, it ain't nothing close to $1 million. So you ask the question, is it worth it? I don't think it is. Just to go back to that 20th anniversary Raw coming up in January, I still think they should have brought that show back to where it all started. I think they should have brought that show to the Manhattan Center in New York City. I believe the show is in Houston, and not New York, so I guess that ain't happening. So anyway, what happens when Raw ratings begin to slip? Why, you dust off Vince McMahon, and you rush him back onto television, which is exactly what they did this week. Only this time, unfortunately for them, it did not work, because they didn't bother promoting it in advance. The first anybody heard of Vince McMahon possibly being on the show was, of course, on WWE.com a couple of hours before. Then they talked about it on the air during the show. But again, that doesn't do you any good if you didn't promote it in advance and let people know, hey, Vince McMahon's going to be on the show. So I believe Vince's segment did better than any other segment on the entire show, but it's not exactly a situation where Vince McMahon being on the show helped lifted them to some great number. Not the case this week. And Vince called Vicky Guerrero out to the ring for his segment. He forced her to make John Cena versus Dolph Ziggler at TLC a Money in the Bank ladder match. And what that means is it'll be a ladder match with Dolph's Money in the Bank briefcase hanging from the ceiling. The briefcase is up for grabs, which is precisely the direction I said last week I was hoping they would not go in. At least it wasn't Ziggler being conned into agreeing to such a stupid stipulation, which is what I was worried about, that he would agree. He would be, you know, coaxed into putting his briefcase on the line. In this case, it was Vince basically forcing Vicky's hand and telling her, look, listen, this is what you're going to do. Dolph did not have a say in it, but I think Ziggler should cash in the briefcase on Raw this Monday, quite frankly, just to fuck Cena out of his shot. You know, have the Shield attack Big Show this week and leave him laying, and then, you know, Ziggler runs down and he wins the World Heavyweight title, or do Big Show versus Sheamus early in the show at TLC, and then have Dolph Ziggler cash in and win, and then his ladder match with Cena becomes a World Heavyweight Championship match. You know, one would be led to believe that with Ziggler getting beaten on television every single week leading up to the pay-per-view that he's going to go over at TLC. He's going to beat Cena. You know, that's the way the WWE tends to book. You don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure that out. If you watch the pay-per-views and you watch the TV shows, you see a pattern. That's just the way they tend to book things. You know, we're going to put this guy over in the end, so don't worry. You know, we can just beat this other guy like a drum in the meantime. So I don't think Dolph is doomed or anything like that. As a matter of fact, David, one of our longtime listeners, emailed one potential idea earlier in the week for the pay-per-view that actually makes quite a bit of sense, or at least it did before Punk had surgery and the main event got changed. You have the Shield attack John Cena at TLC and help Ziggler win his match, because the whole purpose of the Shield, right, what are they? They are a shield against injustice. That's their goal. They fight against injustice in WWE. Well, Dolph won that briefcase fair and square months ago, and so losing it to a guy who already failed with his own cash-in. You know, Cena had his own briefcase, and he lost it. He blew it. Plus, John Cena's had more title shots than everybody else on the roster combined. So that seems pretty unfair to me. So anyway, David's idea was that, you know, what if Ziggler met with the Shield before the pay-per-view to talk about things? And I don't even think Ziggler has to meet with them. I just think the Shield, they decide who deserves help and who doesn't. You know, who deserves help and who deserves to be punished. They can take it upon themselves to interfere, and Dolph keeps the briefcase. But it's probably a moot point now anyway, being that the Shield is going to be busy wrestling in the main event. But all I know is this. If Dolph Ziggler does lose that briefcase at TLC, he better be winning the Royal Rumble. That is the only acceptable outcome to this if John Cena wins at TLC. And I still don't think he is. But if John Cena were to win at TLC, Ziggler just has to win the Rumble. There's just no other way around it. You know, a big Rumble victory would be a nice consolation gift if he were to lose that briefcase. But people would still lose their minds if he loses at the pay-per-view. It's going to be fun, actually, to be there live and just see people's reaction when that match ends, whatever the outcome is, and just see what the general consensus is among people in the crowd in Brooklyn. It's going to be very fascinating, I think, to watch. But back to Raw Monday night, just to go through the show here segment by segment. Opening match had Hell No against the Primetime Players. Michael Cole mentioned that Kane was wrestling here in his 899th match, the most of any superstar in WWE history. And I'm not sure who their resident statistician is, who keeps track of that sort of thing. I'll take them at their word. It seems kind of low to me, actually, for a guy that's been around for 15 years. I mean, maybe they're only counting TV matches, but do you know what, though? Then again, with some time off for injuries factored in, I guess, you know, maybe it's a legit number. Because Kane's had a couple of injuries. I remember back in 02, I think it was, he tore a bicep and he was out for 6 months or 8 months or something like that. He hasn't gotten hurt at the rate that some other main eventers have. I mean, he hasn't come close to matching his brother, The Undertaker, who gets injured just by breathing. Triple H and guys like that. But still, he's had a couple of injuries, a couple of, you know, vacations perhaps. He's been given some time off. Even last year, you know, when Mark Henry, they did the injury angle with Kane on SmackDown. Kane was gone for 4 or 5 months, came back with the mask. So perhaps, I guess, when you factor that in, maybe that is a legitimate number. But, you know, if they're not counting his runs as Isaac Yankem and the fake Diesel, he's well over 1,000 matches at this point. You know, but I assume they're not counting those gimmicks. So one of our listeners, Shane, wanted to know, of those 899 matches, which was my favorite? And it's hard to remember all of Kane's matches and just narrow it down to one. This guy's been around for so long, and he's had so many TV matches. And he's had some pretty good battles over the years. You know, as far as big men go, Kane's a weird one, because I like Kane. I've always liked Kane. I like the original Kane, of course, but I am quite fond of the character. Not so much when he lost the mask and he just looked like Uncle Fester, but Kane is a weird one in that he can have really good matches where it looks like he's motivated and it looks like he's fired up and he's actually flying around the ring. He's a big guy. I mean, Kane is legit, you know, 6'8", 6'9", 300 pounds. He's got 40-something-year-old knees, and he can still move around pretty good. He can move around better than some guys half his size in some cases. And then you have weeks where Kane is in there. Maybe it's just a matter of who he's in the ring with. If he's in the ring with another big guy, those matches tend to suck. So, you know, it's a little Jekyll and Hyde with Kane. He's had some great matches. He's had some really shitty ones. Maybe the best wrestling match I've ever seen Kane in was a U.S. title match against Kurt Angle on SmackDown. That would have been either in 2001 or 2002. It was before. It was sometime before their WrestleMania 18 match, which was not as good. His other memorable matches for me were not necessarily what you would call mat classics, but they were memorable for other reasons. You know, him beating Steve Austin in a First Blood match at the King of the Ring to win the WWF title, which he would promptly lose 24 hours later. But you know what? Even that rematch the next night in Cleveland on Raw when he dropped the belt back to Austin, I watched that match again recently, I think on YouTube, and God, I mean, you go back and watch that match, you have never seen a hotter crowd for a championship match on Raw. I mean, those people were going insane. Insane. But Kane's had a lot of battles with The Undertaker as well. Many of them not good. But, you know, some better than others. His chain match with Triple H stands out to me. They did a chain match once at Judgment Day. That was where Kane won the Intercontinental title. They were doing the whole two-man power trip at the time with Hunter and Austin. Austin accidentally hit Triple H with a chair. Matter of fact, Triple H tore his quad the very next night on Raw. Kane's win over Rey Mysterio a couple years ago at the Money in the Bank pay-per-view, I believe it was, when Kane won the World Heavyweight Championship. You know, his first world title since that 24-hour title run way back in 98. You know, that was the match itself. I think the match literally went about a minute. It wasn't like it was a great match or anything like that, but it was a great moment. So anyway, those are some of the matches that of Kane's career that stand out to me, and it's pretty impressive that a guy of his size has been able to stay as healthy as he has been able to, and can still go. When Kane wants to go, he can go. And, you know, congrats. That's a pretty big accomplishment. If I had to take a guess, I mean, as long as he could stay healthy, I think Kane, quite frankly, I think he's already in his, he's not 40, I want to say he's like 42 or 43, but I think he could go another 3 or 4 years if he really wanted to. The Shield, Ambrose, Rollins, and Reigns. They watched this tag team match that Hell No had against the Primetime Players. They watched it from the crowd. They were inching closer to the ring as it went on. They started to separate, and it was very ominous the way they shot this. It was like this group of invaders, and they're starting to spread out. And you know that bad things are about to happen, but you don't know when. You don't know where they're going to strike. And eventually, Brian pinned Darren Young with a roll-up. The Shield pounced. They attacked Daniel Bryan. We got to see Tyler Black and Bryan Danielson going at it in this segment. I felt like I was back at an ROH show all those years ago. It's a pretty cool moment right there. I mean, if you weren't a Ring of Honor fan, if you weren't familiar with their careers pre-WWE, it probably means absolutely nothing to you. Although one day when the two of them have a great singles match, you'll know. But pretty cool moment. And now, you know, again, maybe they will get to wrestle each other a bit at the pay-per-view coming up. They're going to be part of the same match. I'm sure we will get to see some back and forth between Seth Rollins and Daniel Bryan. So this was actually a really good beatdown. I like the opening of the show. It's very well done. So you would think, you know, after this big beatdown angle, it was handled very seriously. It wasn't treated like a joke or anything like that. So after the serious gang attack, what do we get? Well, we immediately cut backstage to Sheamus and John Cena cracking jokes. Comedy. This angered me. That's all I'm going to say about this. AJ beat Tamina 3 minutes, 20 seconds, or so says the mighty Diva stopwatch. It's actually not bad for a women's match on Raw, to be honest with you. Tamina just beat the crap out of AJ for literally, I mean, if the match was 3:20, she beat the crap out of AJ for about 3:10 of this match. And then AJ just rolled her up and got the pin. So this feud is far from over. CM Punk and Paul Heyman came out for a promo, one of the highlights of Raw every week. Although Punk is getting a bit repetitive, but Heyman is great. Heyman talked about how Punk was about to be, and in fact, he is now, the longest reigning WWE champion of the last 25 years. Since the last big Hogan run, actually, of the late 80s. That was about 4.5 years, I think, that Hogan was champion for. Technically, Hogan lost the title to Andre in February of 88 on the main event on NBC, which is still, by the way, the most watched wrestling match in the history of network television. 33 million viewers. Think about that. 33 million people. But anyway, we're splitting hairs here as far as like when he officially becomes the longest reign. He's got a few more months. He probably actually won't make it since Hogan lost the belt in February. My guess would be that by that time, Rock will be champion. But anyway, for the purposes of this, he is now the longest reigning champion since Hogan. That is legit, and that is also a very big deal. I mean, it is very impressive. In an era where, you know, the fans and the promoters seemingly have the attention span of a 3-year-old child, somehow they managed to keep that title on Punk for more than 380 days, even with the ratings being what they are. So I think the company and Punk deserve a lot of credit for that. And Punk said in this promo here, he said, if it wasn't for me, nobody would have anything to look forward to. And I quote, this is what he said, and I quote, on these dismal 3-hour Monday Night Raws, end quote. That's about as close to a shoot comment as you're ever going to hear on this TV show. I cannot imagine that that line was scripted for him or that the people in the back were too happy about that. But, oh well. Truth hurts. Actually, I am more entertained by Paul Heyman's facial expressions while he stands behind Punk in the background, more so than anything Punk has actually been saying of late on the mic. Heyman's expressions alone give me something to look forward to each week. So Punk then challenged the audience to change the channel if they didn't like what he was saying. He told the fans in the crowd to get up and walk out if they didn't like him. That would have been something if they actually did it. Judging by the ratings, I think the audience at home actually took him up on his offer. Actually, that happened once Miz came out. Then 200,000 people decided that they had seen enough. So yeah, Miz came out. Yet another reason why I cannot take The Miz seriously. His character on this show was more concerned about being Maury Povich than being a pro wrestler. But yeah, I mean, he comes out on this show, Miz does, and I will say this. The fans were reacting better to him this week than they have since he turned. And I can't even really say that he ever turned. I mean, it kind of reminds me of the way that his former tag partner, John Morrison, was turned from heel to babyface, literally in the span of 24 hours without any explanation whatsoever. He popped up one week, Morrison did, on SmackDown, and I'm pretty sure he wrestled as a heel on Raw the night before, or maybe he didn't, but he popped up one week on SmackDown and was just wrestling as a babyface without any explanation. And that is the worst way to turn somebody. But for Morrison, it worked. it did work. He was the exception, not the rule. I don't know if Miz will have as much success as Morrison did, but it was a positive sign for him on this show. He did not challenge Punk to a match. And the reason he did not challenge CM Punk to a match is because, you see, people can see that anytime. No, he wanted Punk to appear on Miz TV to take a lie detector test to prove whether or not he was really working with the Shield. And my reaction to all this was very simple. I literally sat in front of the television while I watched this and I listened to Miz and I said, who cares? Why should anybody care? Why do we have to have a lie detector test to find out whether or not Punk is working in some form or fashion with the Shield? Does Punk get fired if he fails the test? Does he lose the championship? What comes of this? Who cares? That's what annoyed me more than anything else, and this was the main event. This segment turned out to be the main event on the show. And I just thought to myself, who cares? What difference does it make if Punk fails or if he passes? Somewhere in here, The Miz called Paul Heyman a walrus. Punk agreed to take his stupid test. Remember what I said on episode 248? I still think that Punk is telling the truth and does not know it's actually Paul Heyman helping Brad Maddox and The Shield, all these new young guys. Could be wrong, but just remember that. Speaking of Brad Maddox, he was back this week. He was begging Vicky Guerrero for a contract, and she ended up putting him in a match against Randy Orton, and he lost quickly. You know, speaking of asking yourself, why does any of this matter? And I'm just very irritated by all of these logic inconsistencies, I guess you would say, on the show, things that just don't make any goddamn sense. It's hard to suspend one's disbelief that Brad Maddox does not have a contract when the dude has his own Titantron, he has his own YouTube show, which they promote. They go out of their way to promote the Brad Maddox Experience. Why don't they promote Colt Cabana's podcast while they're at it? He's not under contract either. You know, the guy comes out to no theme music. At least, you know, that at least makes sense. I give them credit for that. But he gets an awful lot of TV time for somebody without a contract. I don't have a contract. Solomonster doesn't have a WWE contract, even though some people who write into the show think I do. And they berate me. They say, you're a shill for WWE. You're clearly under contract. And I laugh and block them. But, you know, I'm not under contract. Maybe I could, you know, when I'm at the TLC pay-per-view in 2 weeks or a week, maybe I'll try to get on television. Maybe I want to interview somebody. I could do a better job than Matt Stryker can. Put me on TV. You know, with the Wes Briscoe stuff in TNA, Kurt Angle brought him in as something of a protege. You know, when he was on TV, it was usually with Kurt, and then Kurt helped get him a gut check match, and he ended up winning a contract. This, though, I mean, this is just stupid. Why must we go through this charade? The guy's got a contract. We all know he does. Just let him do his thing. The main event of the first hour, on this show at least, was a tag team match, John Cena and Sheamus, against Dolph Ziggler and The Big Show. John Cena pinned Dolph Ziggler, what else is new, with an AA, which again only solidifies my opinion that Ziggler is winning at the pay-per-view. That's the only logical explanation for all of this. And I know logic and WWE don't often go together, but you know, you beat Ziggler every week and then he wins big at the pay-per-view. At least I hope that's the end result of this. But that was the outcome of this tag team match here. And I have to say, I made an observation as I was watching the show on Monday night. I tweeted that I was a little concerned about Sheamus when he came out. He looked as though he had done a hit of cocaine before he came out to the ring. He had the crazy eyes. If you go back and watch Sheamus when he came out down the ramp and into the ring, his eyes were almost bulging out of his head. He was way, 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 way happier than he should have been. It's okay for people to be happy in life. I know I can sound kind of cranky sometimes. It's good to be happy. It's good to smile. But Sheamus, I don't know. Something seemed off about Sheamus. He seemed overly excited for some reason on Monday night. We had Damian Sandow come out. He has this new gimmick now. I haven't been watching SmackDown all the time, so I'm sure he's been doing this for a few weeks. But this was my first time seeing Sandow do the whole gimmick where he invites a fan into the ring to answer three trivia questions. He's looking for somebody to be his apprentice. And so he brings out fans who I'm pretty sure are plants. from the audience. They get the first two questions right, and then invariably he asks a hard question, and the person can't answer it, and so they fail. And that's what happened here. I think the first question was, he asked, what made H2O, what comprised H2O? Of course, H2O is water. He asked who the first president of the United States was, and the person correctly guessed George Washington. And then he asked, which English poet wrote, "Much have I traveled in the land of gold," which, judging by comments that I've seen people make online, apparently that is incorrect. And the actual line is not "land of gold," it is "realms of gold." But he's Damian Sandow, and nobody's going to tell him that he's wrong. And anyway, the person cannot answer the question. It was very entertaining, actually. I like Damian Sandow. He's very entertaining in this role. It's a shame that Cody Rhodes had to get hurt. I thought the combination of him and Rhodes, the Rhodes Scholars, were also very entertaining. They were really gelling. They had great chemistry as a tag team. I don't know if the plan is to put them back together once Cody is ready to come back. I think inevitably they were going to break them back up anyway, because long term, I'm sure that, you know, the future for Cody is as a singles star as it is for Damian. So it was only a matter of time before that team probably broke up. But it would almost be a shame if they didn't put them back together when Cody came back, unless they have big plans for Cody. So I guess we'll find out what happens. I don't expect Cody to be back in action for at least another month, month and a half anyway. And so in the meantime, Damian has started doing this gimmick, and thumbs up. I find it very entertaining. What I did not find very entertaining was his brief match with Santino, which thankfully did not last very long. Damian won. And this was about as close to a squash as you'll see on Raw, in terms of those old squash matches that we would sometimes see on Superstars and Wrestling Challenge, and even in the early days of Raw. Now they take known people from the roster who are mid-card guys or low mid-card guys, and they beat them, and that's all that Santino really is these days. So Sandow gets the win. We had, let's see here. Well, we had some stuff, the Vince Vicky segment, which I already talked about earlier. There was a match between Sin Cara and Alberto Del Rio, which is notable for the fact that the lights were gone. Those unbelievably annoying, distracting blue lights for Sin Cara were not there. It was a normal match with normal lighting. And the guy didn't wilt away. He didn't evaporate into dust. See? You can have a Sin Cara match with the lights on. It's okay to do that. Hopefully those lights are dead forever. And Sin Cara had a pretty good match here. You know, it was a little slow in spots, I guess. It's not like he was wrestling a Mystico match like he used to back in Mexico. He wrestles the WWE style, which is probably for the better, so he doesn't hurt himself. He already suffered one major injury. In the end, Del Rio got the win with the cross arm breaker. This was fine. They gave them a lot of time too. I didn't time it on the stopwatch, but it felt like over 10 minutes. If it wasn't over 10 minutes, it was pretty close. So the match definitely had some time to it. We had it was supposed to be a tag team match pitting R-Truth and Kofi Kingston against Wade Barrett and Antonio Cesaro. It turned into, and this was unbelievable to me, because you had a tag team match that was already set, right? It was going to be a tag team match. And of all people to come out, Teddy Long comes out. Teddy Long, the master of the tag team match. How many times have we seen Teddy Long over the years on SmackDown and other events come out and announce that it's going to be a tag team match, playa? Well, in this case, he actually changed the tag team match to a four-way match. So this was a monumental edition of Raw for that reason, if nothing else. Teddy Long, of all people, actually canceled a tag team match. I was worried about the guy. I thought maybe he was running a fever or something like that. But you could thank him, because it actually turned out to be the best match on the entire show. They gave the fans the chance to vote. It was the Raw active poll this week. Do you want Cesaro's U.S. title on the line, or do you want Kofi's Intercontinental title on the line? People overwhelmingly voted for Cesaro's U.S. title. Personally, I would have gone for the Intercontinental, but that's the old school WWF fan of me. I guess people just don't like Cesaro, so they wanted his championship on the line, which makes sense. And they had a great match, including Cesaro. Cesaro is very impressive in there. I think many of us who had a familiarity with him prior to him coming over to WWE already knew how good he was, and thankfully, WWE is taking notice. He retained the championship. He got the win in the end. He nailed Kofi with the neutralizer. I don't recall there being any impressive uppercuts. Actually, he may have given Kofi an uppercut on the outside. That was pretty impressive. But nothing like that uppercut on Sheamus that we got a couple of weeks ago. And this was a very good match. This match had some time to it. Everybody was actually very impressive. And the right person won. So thumbs up on this. This was the best match on the entire show. I very much enjoyed it. As opposed to what came next, which was Miz TV. It was the main event. The only thing I could say about this, it was amazing looking at CM Punk on television just burying the Miz. That's the only thing I kind of liked about the segment is the fact that at one point it looked like things were going off the rails a little bit. It was when they were hooking Punk up to the lie detector machine and him and Miz were kind of jaw-jacking back and forth and it looked like it didn't sound like anything that was scripted. They were just kind of riffing on each other. In the end, Miz tried to get the answer to the question that apparently everybody in the world wanted to know. I don't know what world this is that he lives in, but certainly nobody in my world gave a shit about the answer to this question. But he asked the tough question. You know, was CM Punk working with or in cahoots with the Shield? However he phrased it. And Punk seemed very nervous. And before he had a chance to answer, the Shield ran out. And they attacked the Miz. They left him laying. I popped. Daniel Bryan and Kane ran down. There was a big brawl. Ryback eventually came out. He went after, I believe it was Ambrose. He chased Dean Ambrose into the crowd. While Kane and Bryan took care of the other members of the Shield. Eventually, Ryback came back. Attacked CM Punk in the ring. He powerbombed him through a table. People were going nuts for Ryback, so that was a success, if nothing else. That was encouraging to see. And that's how Raw went off the air. So a happy ending if you're a Ryback fan. I could do without seeing lie detector tests on wrestling, certainly in the main event spot. And that was Raw from Monday night. Not the best show. I find myself saying that. More often than not, but the elements that were good were very good, including the four-way match that Cesaro won. I especially enjoyed that. Impact Wrestling from Thursday night, we're going to get to that in just a second, but first, there is a pay-per-view coming up, probably by the time you read this, if not, well, many of you may not listen to the show until later in the week, in which case the event's already over, but TNA has a pay-per-view tonight, Final Resolution from the Impact Zone in Orlando, so they're not going on the road for the show like they are for the lockdown show when they go to the Alamo Dome, which just seems beyond ridiculous to me. They released the seating configuration, by the way. I tweeted a photo of the seating assignments, I guess, configuration, whatever you want to call it, for lockdown. I posted that on Twitter, and it's kind of sad when you really look at it. It's like this humongous dome that fits 70,000 people, and then like in the corner, you see the shaded areas where I think they're gonna make room for about 4,000 people, I believe. It's just, I don't know. I saw that picture. I thought it was fake at first, and to my knowledge, it's legit. And it was just very sad. But in this case, they're keeping it local in the Impact Zone. We have a main event of Jeff Hardy defending the TNA World Heavyweight Championship against Bobby Roode. And I don't see Hardy losing the championship, especially since it's still unknown whether or not Hardy is going to re-sign with the company. I do not see them taking the title off him. So I'll go with Jeff Hardy in that one. We have Bully Ray Hogan taking on Austin Aries. I don't know that we're even going to get a winner in this match. This seems like the beginning of a program here between the two of them. So I would think there may be some sort of schmoz, as Bret Hart might say. But if I had to pick a winner, I would go with Austin Aries. I think it's way too early to beat him here. AJ Styles and Christopher Daniels having supposedly the final match of their career in TNA together. Yeah, right. AJ Styles, my pick in this match. I have nothing to really base it on. I know AJ's been going through some tough times, but I think in the end AJ gets the win and puts Daniels behind him and moves on to whatever the next program is that he's going to be involved in. Obviously, he can't get a title match until Bound for Glory next year at the earliest, so they're going to have to find some stuff for AJ Styles to do, but I'll pick him in that match. Chavo Guerrero and Hernandez will defend their TNA Tag Team titles against Matt Morgan and Joey Ryan. I'll go with Chavo and Hernandez here. I think they retain. Tara will defend her Knockouts title against Mickie James. I'll go with Tara retaining the title. And Rob Van Dam will defend the X Division Championship against Kenny King. Interestingly enough, we'll talk about Kenny King in a second. I imagine RVD retains in that match as well. That's my pick. And there's going to be an 8-man tag on the show. Kurt Angle, Samoa Joe, Wes Briscoe, and Garrett Bischoff will take on the Aces and Eights. And call it a hunch, but I'm going to go with the Aces and Eights. in this match. A lot of good matches on Impact this week, including a great main event. If you missed it, it's worth going back out of your way to see it. And also on this show, the former World Tag Team Champions of the World coming out dressed in Zubaz pants and fanny packs. That made for what was a very memorable and very enjoyable, I felt, edition of Impact Wrestling this week. Daniels and Kazarian, these men can do no wrong. I've decided. They can't do anything wrong. They're great. It really is a shame that tag team wrestling is so weak in 2012. And I know WWE is making an effort to boost their tag division. Let's not be mistaken here. I think it's a good thing that WWE is placing a renewed emphasis on tag team wrestling. I hope it continues. But think everything is relative in life, right? Everything is relative. So you may see something like a match, let's say, on any episode of Raw. You may say, God damn, that was a great match. And I go back and watch that match and I think to myself, what the hell was this person thinking? Well, relative to the quality of matches that you may see in 2012 on any episode of Raw, maybe that was a great match. But if you compare that match, let's say, to a great match from 10 years ago, you see what I'm saying? There may be a very big difference there. Everything is relative. And again, it's a good thing that WWE is making an effort with their tag teams. But make no mistake, tag team wrestling is still pretty dormant. It's still on life support. You know, there really isn't a very strong tag division in either company right now. Even in WWE, you've got Kane and Bryan, right? Hell no, a makeshift team. You had Rhodes Scholars, who are now no more because of Cody's injury. You have the Usos, who aren't really getting pushed anyway. You have the Primetime Players, who were getting pushed. I don't know what the hell's going on with them. You've got Rey Mysterio and Sin Cara. I don't know what's going on with them either. Rey Mysterio was taken off the road. Apparently, he's dealing with some personal matters, whatever that means. So Sin Cara was back on TV wrestling in singles matches this week. The point is, and that's the problem, by the way, that you run into when you have these makeshift teams. My point is, that's all well and good, but tag team wrestling now sucks compared to what it used to be 15 years ago, 20 years ago, 25 years ago. And it really is a shame that these two guys as a team didn't come along back then because they would have been a hit. And that would have been fun. And maybe they just stand out more now because there aren't very many good teams. Maybe if, you know, Daniels and Kazarian came along back during those days, nobody would have batted an eyelash. Because first of all, everybody looked like a monster back then. These guys aren't exactly the biggest. But you had teams like Demolition and the Road Warriors and the Hart Foundation and the Bulldogs and the Freebirds and the Horsemen and, you know, maybe they wouldn't have stood out as much. But I still think to have that level, that quality of tag wrestling now with these guys around, that would have been fun. But anyway, you know, I guess back then, though, Zubaz pants and fanny packs were still in style. So I guess them wearing it on this show would not have been nearly as funny. We also had a title change on Impact this week. D-Von beat Samoa Joe to reclaim his television championship, the one that he never actually lost. It was actually a pretty bad match compared to everything else on the show. Why D-Von was wearing a long-sleeve shirt and a vest on top of that while he wrestled, I'm not quite sure. It does not seem like it would be very comfortable when exerting yourself to be wearing multiple layers of clothing, so that was kind of odd. Hulk Hogan was playing heel on this show. He just, generally speaking, was being a real asshole, particularly towards Bully Ray. He refused to give Bully a match at the pay-per-view against Austin Aries. The same Austin Aries that has been calling his daughter a slut on television every single week. Why Hogan would not want Bully Ray to tear him limb from limb, I don't know. Bully said that by the end of the show he would get what he wanted, and he did. He got what he wanted. I love how Hogan came out later on to confront Bully Ray, and then Brooke came out to try to defuse the situation, and she accidentally called Bully Mark, which was not meant to be a derogatory term. That's his real name, Mark LaMonica. But I like that. I like, for some reason, that sets Hogan off. And he relents at that point, and that's what makes him give Bully the match at Final Resolution. This made no sense at all, unless the storyline is that Hulk Hogan is suffering from dementia, which is entirely possible at his age, and simply doesn't know what he's doing anymore. One minute he says, I'm not going to make the match. The next minute, he makes the match. he was pretty adamant that Bully was not getting that match, and then suddenly he made it. So, I don't know. I just found that whole thing to be very weird. Mickie James came out in heels, and she almost tripped and fell flat on her face coming to the ring, which would have been funny. The fans chanted, "Welcome back," and then Tara came out with her boy toy. She and Mickie argued back and forth, and then Velvet Sky made her big return to Impact, making her first appearance in what Mike Tenay claimed was 6 months. I have no idea whether or not that's accurate, but I'll take his word for it. The fans then chanted, "Welcome back," at Velvet Sky. And I was waiting for Earl Hebner to come out for the next match and hoping the fans would chant "Welcome back" at him too, since they were in such a chanting mood here on the show. Velvet looked different on this show. Her face looked different for some reason. It might have just been the lipstick she was wearing, which was like bright red. I really hope she didn't have any work done on her face. She was a pretty girl, and she still is. I just, you know, you see far too many pretty girls fucking their faces up with plastic surgery, celebrities and such. You know, ladies, don't do that. Be my advice. You know, you're beautiful the way you are. Don't mess that up. You're beautiful the way you are. Isn't that a Bruno Mars song? Or I think Maroon 5 or something? Yeah, whatever. Multiple times throughout the show, they air these ominous vignettes that talked about some road to hell being paved in their own blood. And they listed the date, January 3rd, 2013. It's got to be The Undertaker coming in to wrestle Sting. It's got to be. Chavo and Hernandez beat Robbie E and Robbie T. After the match, they were jumped by Matt Morgan after Joey Ryan distracted them. He called themselves the Big Morgan and the Big Organ. This was the most low-rent indie Val Venus impersonation I have seen in my entire life. And Joey Ryan reminds me of Bill Paxton's character in the movie True Lies. I don't know if I've said this before, but he does. You know, in that, the Paxton's character in the movie is like some used car salesman who pretends that he's a spy in order to impress Arnold Schwarzenegger's wife, played by Jamie Lee Curtis. And he tries to act all cool and all tough, and he is the polar opposite. That's Joey Ryan. And I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. That could be a good thing if he can, you know, if you get people interested enough to watch the show and want to pay money to see this guy get his ass kicked. I don't get that vibe with Joey Ryan. This character, this shtick of his is just, I don't know. To say that it's indie level would be an insult to indie wrestlers, so I don't want to say that, but that's kind of the vibe I get from it. But yeah, the Big Morgan and the Big Organ, I don't know if that's their official team name or not, but if it is, I think they ought to come up with something else. There was an Aces and Eights backstage segment from the janitor's closet, which now features whores and stripper poles. Finally, something I can relate to. Now we're getting somewhere. The head guy, I think they call him the VP or something, he said, "No dark games tonight. Our target has already been decided," and he flashed a bunch of $100 bills, so somebody paid them off. And the head guy said, "Money talks and bullshit walks." That's what he said. And no, they did not bleep it. Kurt Angle beat Luke Gallows by DQ after Aces and Eights ran in to interfere. Samoa Joe, Garrett Bischoff, and Wes Briscoe all ran down to chase them off, and Angle challenged D-Von to an 8-man tag team match at the pay-per-view. I assume that's where they turn on Angle. Not Joe. I assume he gets beaten up too, but... Or maybe they just have Briscoe take the fall and lose, and they just continue to drag this thing out for a few more weeks. I hope they don't do that, though. Just because, you know, stuff like that just screams fake pro wrestling to me. If Wes Briscoe and Garrett Bischoff, if the idea is that they're part of Aces and Eights, along with D'Lo Brown, if that's going to be the big reveal at some point, you know, if they're part of this group, it makes no sense for them to beat up the other members of Aces and Eights just so they can swerve Kurt Angle in the end. You know, to me, that's just dumb. We see that all the time in wrestling angles, but it doesn't make it any less dumb. So hopefully that's not what they do here. Either they do the quick turn on Angle and Joe, and they all gang up on them, or it's a situation where Kurt Angle and Samoa Joe end up spending, you know, the lion's share of the time in the ring, and Briscoe and Bischoff perhaps don't even bother tagging in. You know, they could do that. Jeff Hardy and James Storm had a meeting backstage. Storm walked off, and we got another one of these ridiculous Jeff Hardy mind monologues, where the videos, you know, it turns to slow motion while we hear what Jeff is thinking at that very moment. Make it stop. Please make it stop. Just stop doing this. I beg of you. This might have been more entertaining to hear what Jeff was thinking back when, you know, he was on drugs. I think that could have been very entertaining, actually. But now, thankfully, he's sober. He's on the straight and narrow, and his thoughts are just boring. And in terms of, I mentioned the term fake pro wrestling before, things that scream fake. I don't think it gets any worse than this. So just stop. Kenny King beat Zema, Ion, and Kid Cash in a triple threat match to become the number one contender for Rob Van Dam's X Division title at the pay-per-view. Kenny King, off television for months. They bring him back 1 week, only for him to be the first person eliminated from consideration by Hulk Hogan last week for a title shot. And now he is the number one contender for the X Division championship. Doesn't make any sense to me either, but who cares? They were smart enough to bring back Kenny King, and he and RVD, I think, are going to have a real good match at the pay-per-view. So I say thumbs up on this. Main event was Jeff Hardy, James Storm, and AJ Call Me Emo Styles beating Bobby Roode and Bad Influence, a team of Chris Daniels and Frankie Kazarian, who, as noted at the top of this review, came to the ring wearing Zubaz pants and fanny packs. And they wrestled in the Zubaz pants. Straight out of the Road Warriors closet from 1989. And Taz made it a point, again, on commentary this week to mention the fact that he thinks that song, Gangnam Style, sucks. So I think we got it at this point. I think we understand. You don't like that song. And in the end, Jeff Hardy pinned Kazarian with the Twist of Fate. This was a damn fine wrestling match, I must say. Certainly better than having a lie detector test as your main event. And afterwards, aces and eights, they attacked Jeff Hardy, left him laying. We got a shot of Bobby Roode in the aisleway smiling and giving aces and eights the thumbs up sign. And then he said, "It pays to be rude," which I guess is his new catchphrase. So he was the one who paid off aces and eights. I like it when an angle, even if it's a one-show angle, pays off in the end. So that was Impact, a mostly enjoyable show. The Hogan stuff, you know, the Hogan stuff is what it is. It didn't end the show like it did last week, so that's an improvement. Baby steps. I don't expect things to get, you know, completely better after 1 week, but that was an improvement from what we saw at the end of the show last week. Before we get to the mailbag, I want to address something that Jim Ross had to say in one of his blogs this week. Jim Ross posted a new blog, as he does every week, sometimes multiple times. He posted a new blog on Friday. And there was a mention in the blog that kind of jumped out at me, and I wanted to just share it here. Okay, this is what Jim Ross wrote in his blog this week. He said, "Check out the JBL and Michael Cole show," which is their new show on WWE.com, by the way. It's just Cole and JBL. And I saw the first one. They just talked about random events, non-wrestling stuff. John Cena popped up on there. AJ popped up on there. I don't know if they're going to have wrestling personalities on there every week or not. I didn't watch episode 2 yet. I'll watch it later. But anyway, so JR says, "Check out their new show. I am a regular viewer. It is so much better than some of those one-hour-plus podcasts that some folks do online. I assume some of the aforementioned marathon podcasts work, but my attention span is just too short. At least JBL and Cole get their business done in about 5 minutes." So that's what Jim Ross said in his blog. Now, there's a lot of podcasts, as many of you are well aware, many of which are an hour, some of which are 2 hours. Some of them have multiple hosts, some of them have one host, like this one. A lot of different podcasts out there. It's good to be a wrestling fan if you're into that sort of thing, because you have a lot of options out there. And people listen to these shows for a variety of different reasons. I mentioned earlier, I get a ton of emails from people telling me that they don't even watch Raw anymore because they don't have the time to, it's just too boring, 3 hours is too long, WWE sucks, whatever their rationale is. And they go out of their way to tell me that even so, they listen to this show, they listen to the Sound Off to keep up with what's going on. it's actually easier and more enjoyable for them to just listen to me talk about what happened on Raw than it is to actually watch the show itself. So, for that reason alone, this show, for example, could never be 5 minutes long. I mean, every now and then when I do a podcast that's under an hour, I get so many tweets and emails, and I see Facebook posts from people who are just devastated. They're so upset that the show was 10 or 15 minutes shorter than usual. It legitimately upsets people. I don't know who JR was referring to. He wasn't referring to this show. I'm sure he was referring to one of the other, you know, big shows that goes... And there's a lot of other shows that don't even go an hour, that go 45 minutes or so. Maybe he was referring to one of those. He didn't, you know, give an indication of who he was referring to. But being that I do a show that would qualify, I wanted to just chime in here and say this. I can understand where JR is coming from and that it can be a long time for somebody to sit down and listen to something, and people don't have the attention span that you would perhaps want them to have. And JR is entitled to his opinion. I enjoy listening to, whether it's a wrestling podcast or not, I you know, enjoy listening to shows that sometimes go 30, 40, 60 minutes. He doesn't. He likes OU football games. I don't. I think college football is boring. But I will say this. If JR doesn't like long wrestling podcasts because he has a short attention span, I would ask JR this one question. Can you please go to your boss and tell him that I don't like 3-hour wrestling shows? Why don't you try to get him to do something about that? Time for the mailbag. We've also just exceeded the 1-hour mark on this week's show, so I know Jim Ross is not listening. You can submit questions to me, shout-outs, all that stuff at thesolomonster@gmail.com. TheSolomonster, very important to put the word the first. TheSolomonster@gmail.com. David from Texas turns 24 today, so happy birthday, David. Udit Sharma from New Delhi, India, listener since episode 156. He celebrated a birthday of his own on December 6th, so happy birthday to Udit as well. Dave writes in. Wow, a lot of Daves out there. Dave from Southern California. He's hoping to get a shout-out for his mother's birthday, which is coming up in the next couple of weeks. So happy birthday, Dave's mom. He says, Matt Hardy recently said in an interview that it is highly likely there will be a Hardy Boys reunion in WWE sometime in 2013. Is this a bit of a tease that Jeff will in fact return to WWE? The fact it came from his brother and not an internet insider makes me believe that Matt and Jeff have discussed coming back. Well, of course, they would be fools not to at least discuss the possibility of coming back and keep all their options open. You know, I'd love to know what makes Matt think that WWE would even want him back. And by him, I mean Matt, not Jeff. You know, Jeff they would take back in a heartbeat. You know, it looks like Matt's been on the straight and narrow for the past several months, which is great. But I think he's more baggage, quite frankly, than he's worth. If I'm WWE, I don't know that I'm all that interested in taking Matt Hardy back. Unless they bring his girlfriend in with him, I think a Rebby Sky-Matt Hardy combo would be an interesting addition to the WWE roster. Rebby is very attractive. If you've never seen a picture of her, she was a former, you know, Playmate of the Month or Playmate of the Year, I forget. Just Google her name, Rebby, R-E-B-Y. She's a very attractive girl. And a big sports fan, too. Big New York Giants fan. But she's very attractive. She seems like a perfectly acceptable wrestler from what I've seen of her. She does wrestle independently. You know, I could see that. I could see Matt Hardy and Rebby Sky coming in together. Although, if Matt knows what's good for him, judging from the past, and his past specifically, he'll keep his girlfriend far, far away from WWE. As far as Matt and Jeff together, when I read that, I took it for what it was. It was Matt Hardy trying to stir the pot and keep his name out there. He's very good at that. Everything I'm reading suggests that Jeff will probably end up staying in TNA. And even if he did go back to WWE, the real money, long term, is in him as a single star, not as part of some tag team with his brother. You know, I think initially a Hardy Boys team would be a great addition to the tag team division in WWE. You know, those first couple of months. And Jeff's got a track record himself, so, you know, maybe it's best when you bring him back to first have him as part of a tag team those first 2, 3, 4 months. But ultimately, he's got to be a single. You know, Jeff's not getting any younger. I think he's up there. He's 34, 35 years old, beaten up. However many number of years he's got left, his value is as a singles performer, not a tag team wrestler. But as far as Matt Hardy goes, I would not take anything that Matt says very seriously. Kieran from Sheffield, England. Been listening to the show for many years. He's got two topics to cover. First up, do you think the concept of Taboo Tuesday / Cyber Sunday worked? These days we have Raw active, but we've seen reports of inaccurate results and poor choices being offered during the voting. I remember when the pay-per-views were around, the choices were a lot more balanced, as opposed to, say, having to choose Miz in a poll over Santino and Zack Ryder. Do you think the concept worked of those old pay-per-views? And to your knowledge, was the voting legitimate? Well, obviously, if Cyber Sunday was a success, it would still be around. The fact that it's not pretty much confirms that it was a failure. And yes, to my knowledge, the results back then, the voting results, were genuine. I think the main reason for that may have had to do with the fact that it was mostly, if not entirely, text messaging back then used for voting. I mean, maybe you could also do some voting back then on WWE.com, but I know they were doing the SMS, you know, text voting, and standard text messaging rates would apply, and because of that, by law, they could have, you know, they could not put forth fraudulent results. This was before WWE fell in love with Twitter and started doing hashtag voting, which doesn't cost you anything and could be manipulated any which way they wanted. So to my knowledge, it was genuine. Kieran's second question concerns Umaga, who passed away 3 years ago this week. Kieran says, I thought he was a very agile wrestler for his size and was good in the ring. What do you think, or what did you think, rather, of Umaga's in-ring work and character, and what led to him leaving the company? I think Umaga was a very underrated worker. He moved around very well for a man of his size, and he had some very good matches. You know, particularly, I remember some pretty memorable matches with him and Jeff Hardy. And there was a last man standing match at Royal Rumble, I want to say 06, it was 06 or 07, that he had with John Cena that was actually very good. I remember it exceeded my expectations. I didn't have high hopes for it going in, and they had a hell of a match. I was never a fan of his gimmick, because it just reeked of 1980s cartoon character. I could not believe they chose him for that Battle of the Billionaires match at WrestleMania for that very reason. You know, with all the mainstream publicity that match was going to get, and you knew it was going to get because Donald Trump was involved, you know, the press conferences and everything, and you take a completely unrealistic character like that and make it one of the featured performers in that storyline, I didn't like that. And by the time Umaga, you know, the character dropped the savage stuff and actually started speaking English, because a lot of people may not remember the fact that, at least on one episode of SmackDown that I vividly recall, I recall somebody was upside down in the corner in a tree of woe, whoever Umaga was feuding with. I don't know if it was Kennedy, maybe. I don't know who it was. And then he like, said his first words in perfect English. And it was like, wow. Finally, they're going to have him speak like a normal person. But by that time, I think he was already gone not long after that. I always thought there was potential in an Undertaker-Umaga program, and maybe an Undertaker-Umaga WrestleMania match, but unfortunately, it never happened. As far as what led to his departure from the company, in 2009, he failed a wellness test. And it was actually his second wellness failure, and he refused to go to rehab. And I think when you fail twice, it's mandated that you go to rehab. He refused. And so they fired him. You know, his refusal to go to rehab or even admit the fact that he had a problem in the first place is what probably led to his death, ultimately. You know, the following year is when he had the heart attack, and they found the pain pills and the muscle relaxers in his system. Just a very sad story. He was a very young guy. He had, you know, a couple of kids, I think. Seemed to be very well-liked by people in the company. Very well-liked. And just a shame to think that, it's been 3 years already that Umaga died. But, that comes from Kieran. So hopefully that answers your question. Armand writes in, no question this week, just wanted to say amen to your comments about not every wrestler being a main event star. I cannot stand Zack Ryder or The Miz, Cody Rhodes, Kofi Kingston, or Jack Swagger, all of whom the internet crowd seems to love. For that matter, I also can't stand the hyperbolic accolades they seem to get. Thank you for going against the grain and being honest about talent in 2012 and the reality about what it takes to get to the top. That comes from Armand. Simon Penny from Great Yarmouth, England. I'm a relatively new listener to your show, currently running on my third consecutive week. I needed something to fill my aftermath void, and may I say, you have blown it out of the water. Well, thank you for that. Anyway, he says, an observation. I'm not totally anti-Miz, although I was more a Morrison guy when those two tagged up and would have expected Miz to be Jannetty'd. I ask, though, who exactly is the Miz trying to be? Is he trying to be Jericho? Is he trying to be a modern-day version of Rowdy Roddy Piper? Surely he would be better off taking note of the sleeve of each of his pointless t-shirts and actually try to, quote, be Miz. The way I see it, there's room for a Miz, but we don't really need a copycat Y2 Hot Rod. That comes from Simon. Well, if he is trying to pattern himself after Roddy Piper, he needs to stop doing that right now. I've heard people say the same thing about Dean Ambrose. I don't want these guys to be categorized as the second Roddy Piper or the second Chris Jericho or the second anybody, and then they fail to meet expectations. Let them be themselves. I think, you know, sometimes you'll hear wrestlers say, you know, Dolph Ziggler, for example, gets compared to Shawn Michaels and Ric Flair. Mostly Shawn Michaels. And I'm sure he takes that to be a great honor that somebody would compare him to two of the best wrestlers in the history of the business. But somebody like Dolph might then turn around and say, listen, I don't want to be the next Shawn Michaels. I want to be the first Dolph Ziggler. And I think that's a great quote because there's a lot of truth to that. Dean Ambrose, for example, let him be the first Dean Ambrose. He reminds me a little bit, you know, personally of Brian Pillman. But that doesn't mean that I want Dean Ambrose to be the next Brian Pillman. I want him to be the first Dean Ambrose. And I think there's something to be said for that. I think that's what Miz is doing. He's trying to be himself. It just so happens that Miz is a genuinely unlikable person. Maybe not in real life. Maybe in real life he's the nicest guy. But his character is unbelievably annoying. He is so damn easy to hate. And they're trying to get him over as a babyface. I'm sure in the end it'll work. Eventually WWE, you know, they shove anything and everything down your throat. You know, like bad medicine, and you may not want to take it at first, but ultimately it goes down. I'm sure in the end it'll all work out, but the way they're going about doing it, turning him babyface right now, is just bizarre to me. You know, besides, Piper was a genuinely controversial character. There is nothing controversial at all about The Miz. He's so sanitized, you know, he's like a WWE robot. They can call him Robo-Miz. That's how I feel whenever, like, I hear him on commentary, for example, on Main Event or some other show. Then, when he is put in a position to speak on his own, like when he had that little exchange with Punk during the whole lie detector segment on Monday night, and his big comeback to something that Punk said, I forgot what it was, his big comeback was a Yo Mama joke, or Your Mama, I'm sorry. I still remember it used to be Yo Mama back in the day. Again, I'm dating myself there. But his big comeback was a Your Mama joke. And the crowd reacted to it, but really? A Your Mama joke? What are you, seven? I think for Miz to be Miz, he should be a chicken shit heel. That role was made for him. And just run with it. Be the biggest chicken shit heel you can be. Go all the way with it. You know, give him a Ralphus-type character. Remember Ralphus? The truck driver who became Chris Jericho's manager in WCW, he had like missing teeth and a t-shirt that didn't fit his belly. You know, it was a great combo. It was very, very creative, very entertaining. Give Miz a Ralphus-type manager. Not a protege like Alex Riley, who looks like everybody else that comes out of developmental. You know, and I think he would be very entertaining in that role, Miz would be, with somebody like that. And it would be more true to his personality. Because he's not a tough guy. You know what I mean? Neither am I. If I were in WWE, I'd be a great chicken shit heel. Are you kidding me? Either that or I'd be a really sympathetic babyface that people just feel sorry for. You know. I get that it may not have been his call to turn babyface. It was the company's decision. He's got some family Christmas movie coming out soon. He's in the Marine 3. Who cares? It's 2012. They've got David Otunga, a heel on television, running around doing Be a Star rallies with kids, looking like the greatest guy in the world. They put this video out the other day with all the WWE stars singing Jingle Bells, their own version of Jingle Bells. Apparently that was the brainchild of this new person they put in charge of creative who came from Hollywood. It was his idea to put that whole thing together. So you have all the heels and all the baby faces standing next to each other singing Christmas carols. people who are feuding with each other right now. It's just standing side by side smiling and singing Christmas carols. It's 2012. Kayfabe is dead. You can play one person on TV and be somebody else in the movies. Miz can be in a family Christmas film and still be a douchebag on television. It's okay. Richard Sanders from Bowling Green, Ohio writes in, been a listener since episode 70. Do you think Brian Pillman would have been world champion had he not passed away prematurely? And do you think Pillman should be inducted into the WWE Hall of Fame? If so, who should induct him? In my opinion, had Pillman come along in the last 10 years, I think he absolutely would have been a world champion, especially with there being two titles and with Edge being champion. You know, I single out Edge because I think Pillman was the original rated R superstar. I mean, go back and look at what he was doing, especially after his car accident. The stuff he did in ECW and the stuff he did in you know, the early part of his WWF run. He was pushing the envelope before it became cool to push the envelope. Now, had he not died in 1997, had he lived, would he have been a world champion? No, I don't believe he would have been. You know, truthfully, I don't know how much longer Pillman would have been able to physically wrestle with his ankle being in the shape that it was in. I mean, he was in constant pain. By all accounts, he was in pain all the time. His ankle was shattered in that Hummer accident in 96 where he wrapped his car around a tree. And his ankle had to be fused into one position. He was never the same performer after that he was in WCW. Not even close. And there had been talk anyway that he was looking at getting back into WCW at the time of his death. And look who was on top in WCW at that time. Look at the people who were on top. Look at who the champion was. Hulk Hogan and his buddies, all the big names. There's absolutely no way Brian Pillman would have been champion. At least not in WCW, if he would have ended up going back there. Not a snowball's chance in hell. And I think that once Montreal happened, had he still been around, with his loyalty to Bret Hart, he would have requested to go to WCW anyway, just like Davey Boy Smith did. You know, now whether he would have been willing to pay out of his own pocket to buy out his contract the way Bulldog did, I think Bulldog had to pay Vince McMahon $150,000 to buy himself out of his contract so he can go to WCW. Vince wouldn't even let Owen Hart out of his contract. You know, you look at the timeline. The Attitude Era was about to kick into full swing. So the timing would have been perfect to have Pillman on top with his friend, Steve Austin, feuding for the title. I just don't think he would have been there long enough to see that actually become a reality. So for that reason, I don't think he ever would have become champion. Should Pillman be in the Hall of Fame? Absolutely. And I think he deserves it, and I think if he ever gets in, Steve Austin is the only person that really makes sense to induct him, and I'm sure Steve Austin would love to do so. This comes from Bruce. Just curious as to your opinion outside of hatred of this whole John Cena-AJ storyline. To me, it seems that WWE thinks AJ cannot be used effectively without being in a relationship angle. Also, I think WWE is trying to recreate the success of Daniel Bryan and AJ, but with their most popular superstar instead. What do you think? Not exactly. You know, I think the idea in putting Bryan and AJ together was that it would be of help to Bryan to help get him over a little bit more, and I think it worked. John Cena is already as over as he's going to be. How much higher can John Cena go? It's not like he has trouble, you know, getting reactions from the crowd. He's been around for 10 years. I think John Cena, you know, he doesn't need any help. Yeah, but here's the thing. You may have a point on them always putting AJ in relationship angles, even from her debut on that Diva season of NXT. They teased a little puppy love with her and Hornswoggle. You know, they had her and Primo together at one point. They were teasing that they were an item. And then it was her and Daniel Bryan, and then she was kissing CM Punk, and then she was kissing Kane, now it's John Cena. This girl gets around. Clearly somebody taught her very early on that the best way to get to the top of the wrestling business is to sleep your way to the top. Well, I mean, we presume she was sleeping with at least some of these guys in storyline. And it's certainly paying off for her. You know, come to think of it, Jay Lethal, who I interviewed on Sound Off 187, by the way, cheap plug, he was AJ's trainer, and he dated her also. If you type in Jay Lethal, AJ Lee, into Google search, not that I've ever tried this before, but if you do it, you'll find a lot of personal photos of Jay Lethal and AJ on a beach. They're on vacation. They're hugging. And you know, she learned right from the beginning, it seems. Keith writes in, we all know about Jake Roberts and his graphic history with drugs and alcohol abuse, as well as the many excuses we heard from him over the years. I've been keeping up on his recovery with DDP, and I must admit I'm very impressed and happy for Jake. He seems to look a lot healthier and slimmer than he has in years. There's no doubt that Jake Roberts is a wrestling legend, and he's definitely Hall of Fame worthy, just a matter of time. I would love for Jake to make an appearance at the Royal Rumble. I honestly think he would get one of the loudest pops in Rumble history. This can set up a possible induction into the Hall of Fame, and it'll be nice to see DDP induct his mentor. Jake only needs to stay in the ring for a minute or two and deliver a couple of DDTs. For fuck's sake, Michael Cole had a spot in the Rumble. What are your thoughts on this? I would be fine with that. You know, I don't even know if Jake can do DDTs anymore. I mean, maybe now he can. I know DDP, you know, DDP, for those of you who don't know, has Jake Roberts in house right now. They rented out a house, I think it's in the Atlanta area. And I don't know if it's being filmed for a reality show or not. You read about this and it sounds like a reality show made to happen. But he's got Jake in a house and he's training him. He's having him do DDP yoga. Jake has already lost like 40 pounds or 60 pounds or something like that. Is feeling as good as he's ever felt. There's a couple of videos of Jake talking about it on YouTube floating around. It's worth checking out, actually. And, you know, maybe now he can do DDT. I just know, like, you know, Hulk Hogan, for example, can no longer do leg drops. His back, his spine, they're all so fucked up. He can't even drop the leg anymore. So Jake, I don't even know if Jake can drop down, you know, more than once maybe to do a DDT. Maybe one time he can. But I would be fine with that. You know, as a surprise entrant, if Jake feels healthy enough physically and mentally to do it, then why not? I don't know how good he's moving around these days, but like I said, I've heard great things about what DDP's yoga has done for other people. Shawn Michaels uses it. Chris Jericho, he claimed it saved his life. It saved his career. He had herniated discs in his back before his last WWE comeback. All he did was DDP yoga, and he felt like $1 million after doing it. But here's the thing about Jake. If he thinks that being back in the spotlight, being back on TV, even if only for a few minutes, if that might somehow derail his progress, if that might be a bad thing or set him back somehow in his recovery, then I say it's not worth it. But if he thinks he can do it, I got no problem with that. As a surprise entrant in the Rumble, why not? David from Texas. I've caught some of your sound offs from TV Tracks and became a listener of the show when you did your Top 30 Raw Moments episode. My question is, what did you think of the whole GTV thing during the Attitude Era? There really wasn't much to think about. They would show hidden camera footage from the locker room area each week. You know, not unlike those videos that popped up on YouTube a couple of weeks ago from the fake Brad Maddox account that showed supposedly naked footage of some WWE divas, which was, I think, bullshit. But that's basically what GTV was. Goldust was supposed to be behind it, hence the G in GTV. But plans change, the idea got dropped, and that was that. My favorite GTV moment, and one of the few I actually remember, has to be Val Venus and the Big Show in the men's room. Val, they're both by urinals with their backs turned, obviously. And Val looks over at Big Show standing next to him, and he laughs, and he says, "And they call you the Big Show?" And then Big Show just beats the crap out of him and leaves him laying. It was just very simple, very stupid, but very funny. And very clever, I thought. Just Joe... Anybody remember Just Joe? That was another one of those silly gimmicks they came up with that's so stupid you can't help but laugh. It was this guy named Joe, obviously, and I don't remember him even wrestling all that much. He would just stir shit up in the back. That's what his character did. He would pop into someone's dressing room and tell them that, you know, the boys in the back are talking about this or they're talking about that. Or so-and-so said something about you. This is what they said about you. And he was a troublemaker. He was a troublemaker, but whenever the wrestler he was talking to, like, if it was a main eventer, you know, they would ask, "Who the hell are you?" His trademark response would be, "Just Joe." Again, dumb, but funny. Vince Russo, I think, was responsible for the GTV stuff, but he gets no credit for Just Joe, because Just Joe came along in 2000, after Russo was already gone. So I give Vince Russo zero credit for Just Joe. But no, I mean, those were some actually pretty funny gimmicks, I have to say. That was a fun period in wrestling, I gotta tell you. That was such a fun period. Ugh, now I'm all depressed. Lastly, this comes to us from Ricky. Greetings and salutations, sir. Sir Solomonster, actually, is what he calls me here. I hope your day has gone quite swimmingly through your many minutes of witty verbiage. I would like to call to your attention a certain bet made of minuscule importance in episode 172 of The Sound Off. Had anyone brought to your attention that bet? And if not, I present to you a cut of that clip for your self-ear-pleasuring listening leisure. May your mouth never be conquered by a band of marauding Vikings. So that comes from Ricky, apparently straight out of the 16th century. Either that or it's Damien Sandow masquerading as somebody named Ricky. Here's the clip of this bet that he is referring to, which I had completely forgotten about. Here's the clip. The other big news of the day here, just to mention really quick, WWE has hired a new person to come onto their creative team, Kevin Eck, who was the person behind the Ring Post column on the website for the Baltimore Sun. He's done a lot of really good interviews with a lot of top-flight talent from WWE in the past. Vince McMahon, Stephanie McMahon, I believe, Triple H, Steve Austin, John Cena, a whole bunch of different people. And I've enjoyed reading his columns online, pretty good stuff. And he apparently is going to be surrendering that column. I believe he is beginning with WWE later this month, so sometime in the next couple of weeks, obviously after SummerSlam at some point. And he will be working in creative. I don't know exactly in what capacity. I don't know if he'll just be another member of the team, if he'll be working in a specific division, or what have you. But I think it's interesting. You know, here's a guy who is a former journalist, and not only just a former journalist, but a columnist, a wrestling columnist, the type of person that WWE would typically spit on and frown upon. And, you know, he's not exactly what you would call a, quote, dirt sheet writer, which I hate that expression, but they did allow their talent to be interviewed by him, but that's only because he worked for a legitimate, respectable publication like The Sun. And it'll be interesting to see how long he lasts. I'm already taking bets to see how long he lasts. He's moving to Stanford, so he's really committed to this. He's uprooting everything. He's moving to Connecticut, and he's going to be working there full-time. And I give it about, 8 months. So 8 months from now is what? What is 8 months from August? Is that April? So right around WrestleMania next year. I want everybody listening to mark that down. I want you to remember this. In 8 months from now, I want you to email me and let me know if I was right or wrong, because I'm going to forget I even made this bet tomorrow. I give him 8 months before he either quits or gets fired. People don't last very long in WWE creative. They really don't. There are a few people that have been there for a number of years. You know that Brian Gewurz, probably the longest reigning current writer that they brought in, which came in pretty much, I think, at the tail end of the Attitude Era. But aside from him, a lot of faces have come and gone, people who are just frustrated with how things work behind the scenes in WWE. And, you know, maybe if Triple H is truly being worked into a bigger role creatively and with the developmental system and all that, perhaps he'll be, you know, a positive influence and a more sane influence than Vince McMahon tends to be. I don't know. But, hey, you know, best of luck to the guy. Hopefully it'll work out. And, I don't know, 8 months later, I think he'll be back with The Sun, but that's just me. That was from episode 172, way back in August of last year. And I can report that Kevin Eck is indeed still employed by WWE, although I will admit I do not know if it is still in a creative capacity or not. I know he does stuff for the website. My guess would be that he is still involved with creative in some way, so I will admit I was wrong. He lasted a hell of a lot longer than I ever thought he would. But I will point this out. Even when I'm wrong, I'm still right. I mentioned that Brian Gewurz in that clip, who had been the longest tenured member of Creative up until a couple of months ago when he was dumped, I mentioned Brian Gewurz's name in that clip, and ironically, Gewurz is now gone. So it's kind of funny that here I was talking about how this guy won't last, and they rarely do for any length of time in Creative, and then Gewurz being the exception, and here we are, Eck is still around and Gewurz is gone. So it's funny how that works. So my thanks to Ricky for that. I don't know if he actually expected me to play that on the air or if he was just trolling, thinking I wouldn't actually do it, but I don't mind pointing out when I'm wrong. You know, I point that when I'm right, so I can point that when I'm wrong as well. What I am not wrong about, though, is that that was a hell of a mailbag this week. Very enjoyable, very good questions. Keep sending them in to me. TheSolemnMonster@gmail.com. I read everything you guys send, and I try to get as much of it on the air as possible. I'm not always successful, but we had a nice big mailbag the last 2 weeks, so if you send in a shout-out or a question, there's a pretty decent shot it will probably make its way on the air or get answered in some way, shape, or form. So keep sending that in. You can follow me on Twitter, @SolemnMonster. We're now well above 1,800 followers and counting. So hopefully I can count you among them, @SolemnMonster. Facebook.com/TheSolemnMonster is the official profile page for yours truly. You can send me a friend request. I will approve you. And please do so before Raw this Monday night. That way you can get in on the Raw thread that we have going each and every week. A lot of good debate back and forth always in that thread. Hundreds of comments. Now that the show is 3 hours long, we get a lot more comments, obviously. And you can also subscribe to the show for free in iTunes. Type in Solemnmonster Sounds Off. You can subscribe. And every time an episode is posted, it will be automatically downloaded to your feed or however it works. And if you can also leave a review for the show, that is always appreciated. You can leave a star rating. You can leave a little review. It only helps the show. So I very much appreciate those who do that. So that's episode 249 for this week. I want to thank each and every one of you for downloading the show or streaming it from anywhere in the world, wherever you may be. And also, don't forget again, episode 250 next weekend, maybe posted a little bit earlier. I'll have TLC pay-per-view predictions. I am on my way to TLC along with Brian Blade. And the week after that, I'll have a live, I'll probably talk a little bit about that actually on SE Scoops Live on December 17th, the night after TLC. And then I'll have full thoughts on the show as well on episode 251 of The Sound Off. So those are some fun things coming up for everybody to look forward to. And until next time, be well, stay safe, enjoy the TNA Final Resolution pay-per-view if you are one of the 18 who are watching it tonight. And we'll be back next week with another show. So until then, take care, guys.
Let me tell you something, fella. This is Joe from Northern Ireland.
Hi, I'm AJ Grimaldo.
And quite simply, the fastest 60 minutes on the internet.
The Solemnmonster Sounds Off on SEScoops.com.